Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the Campaign Against Living Miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
It's that time.
What time?
High time to say if you've got time to give this time your time, then it's time to let this time spend time making your time a good time on this time.
Monkey Tennis, please, please, cook your eggs. Be safe. Be egg safe. Monkey Tennis?
Well, have a glass of water, please.
It falls to me to say he is gone. Monkey Tennis? I said I'd find out more. I haven't done that.
Pay for dinner, yeah?
Monkey Tennis?
I said, who the hell is that?
That's merely a shaved boy in a wig. Monkey Tennis?
There is broad agreement that John was good.
Tommy, join me at the lady.
The show that promises to be all things
to all men.
And all women.
And everything in between.
Monkey Tennis?
There's a subtle cock up there.
Hello everyone and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. I'm Adam Brooks and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
Imagine the look on Hugh Edwards' face when he finds out I'm interviewing Princess Anne.
Nick Alder.
Imagine the look on Lorraine Kelly's face when she finds out I'm interviewing Princess Anne.
And Tom Stubb.
Imagine the look on Noel Edmonds' face when he finds out I'm interviewing Princess Anne.
So, welcome to our deep dive into episode 5 of series 2 of This Time with Alan Partridge, as you will have hopefully already seen on BBC One or iPlayer, or on a pirate site if you're living in one of the many countries around the world that enjoy the cream of our discharge. yes, imagine kicking off your shoes, digging into a box set of Monkey Tennis episodes with that dry cake you like, then times it by 10. How do you feel? Before we get into the meat of episode 5, I think there's a few things have cropped up over the last few weeks in the APU that we should address. Who's got the first of those things?
I think I can open this with something that we didn't spot a couple of weeks ago, and I'm pretty ashamed that we all missed it, but I guess that's the nature of us trying to get these episodes out quickly. So the episode where Alan talks through his new kind of kitchen utensils drawer system, and there's an animation of a house. That house is located at 10 King Road. An absolutely brilliant Easter egg for long-time Partridge fans there.
Amazing.
Thanks to all the people that messaged us about that, and it's many, and the messages are coming in every day, so I thought we should definitely address that now. Yes, we know. Sorry you missed it, but it's a brilliant joke, and we've really enjoyed it.
And crucially, please stop contacting us about it.
We've got the message.
Also, it's probably a bit remiss of us to not have spoken about the opening credits yet. So should we do a little dissect of those?
Absolutely. So what's changed? Crucially, what's changed?
What?
So as far as I can tell, I think all of Jenny's sequences remain intact, but I think all of Alan's sequences are now different.
Am I right in thinking that there are now more sequences with both of them in the same shot as well, which I don't think they had in series one?
There's a whole kind of the sequence towards the end when they're entering TV center, or sorry, broadcasting house. Yeah, that is new and different.
So yeah, the scene of Alan and Jenny entering the BBC means that tragically we've lost the best character from these opening credits, which is the receptionist who used to roll her eyes at Alan in series one when he did a little point with his driving gloves.
It's nice to see that we've got some wider APU nods. We see the Oast House, which I thought was interesting because obviously that's, you know, technically is it an Amazon property? You know, sort of multiple stakeholders having different kind of...
I don't think they own the building, Nick.
but yeah, it was nice to see kind of wider APU icons in the opening credits.
I spotted two interesting things about the Oast House shot. You will have to pause to get this, but... from what I can see, and I don't know the technical word for this, but you know there's like the kind of the pointed top of the Oast House and there's like a kind of a spout on top.
Mm-hmm.
One, you see that swing round, which I just thought was quite weird. And two, because that movement caught my eye, there's a bird on it. So I thought, that must be Morris.
Morris.
Yeah.
Also, if you pause it on the Oast House, if you look very closely in the top right-hand corner, you can see a figure in the window. So as we now know... that is Rosa, and I guess we obviously in the first series had the Denton Abbey. There you go, my mind went blank for a second there. The mysterious figure in the window there that I think we can finally attribute that is Rosa as well, and Alan's cleaner has gone from Denton Abbey to the Oast House.
Gokumpa. yeah, I think it's safe to confirm that as Rosa.
And you've also obviously got that repeated shot of him dancing with the Caribbean lady, which we've previously seen. Is it in the credits of Welcome to the Places of My Life?
It's in Welcome to the Places of My Life, and I think it was in the end credits of Scissored Isle. And it's just a really great thing where they've always randomly inserted it when the original footage that it's from is never featured in anything. And obviously that's the joke, and it's a brilliant running gag that... you know, again, like, it's a great Easter egg gag for long-term fans of Alan.
Perhaps it's also a case of that thing you were talking about on a previous episode of sort of trying to display your diversity. He's clearly shot one segment a long time ago with a woman of Caribbean origin and is now milking that diversity for all it's worth by putting it in the credits of every show since.
If we ever get the opportunity to speak to Steve or the Gibbons, I'm going to ask, when was that shot? Because... if you look at his hair, I think you can place Alan Ira's judging by his hair. It's relatively short. It looks almost sort of... it, obviously, I don't think it's quite far back as I'm Alan Partridge Series 2, but it's not as long as it was in Alpha Papa, and it's not as long as it is now. So,
Tom, I think the easy answer is I'm pretty sure that was shot as part of Welcome to the Place of My Life, because that is the first time it's surfaced.
Right, okay,
yeah.
That makes sense, yeah. But I wonder if what the wider context of that was, because it was obviously filmed for... a wider piece, and obviously it never
I wonder though if it wasn't, and it's very much the joke is that there is no more context. I mean, and it will keep on popping up.
That would be something to ask the Gibbons or Steve at some point in the future if we get the opportunity. And also, of course, you have the Waka Waka added from first week. There was no Waka Waka, and then obviously Alan talks about they've added a Waka Waka. From episode two onwards, Waka Waka.
They'd come for the theme tune, but he did not speak out because he was not a theme tune.
A couple of other quick points on this. He's eating like a... is he just like having a
British
Isles breakfast? Like a fry up?
British Isles breakfast.
He's eating it incredibly awkwardly, like almost missing his mouth. That's quite weird. and also the way he's like doing his key fob when he's coming out of the Oast House is also really awkward. Like he's trying to run and look a bit athletic or something. And somebody did get in touch thinking the shot when Jenny and Alan walk into Broadcasting House, there are some people on the screen like holding up their fingers. And somebody thought it was basically somebody giving a middle finger to Alan and Jenny. But having paused it, I don't think it is that. I think it's, you have to forgive me for not knowing the detail, but I think in some countries you get like the tip of your finger inked when you voted. And I think that's what it is. It's people showing they voted.
Oh,
okay. So anything else from the APU before we get into this week's episode proper?
I just want to repeat, we know that the house was 10 King Road.
I like the idea that, you know, 20 odd years later, Alan can't think of another fictitious address. Like, that's the first one that comes to mind. So into the episode, the first thing I noticed straight off the bat with the cold open with Lynn is that Alan's swimming must have improved significantly since the last time we saw him sort of floundering while trying to interview people, because he's diving off the top board these days, and when asked why, because he can, Lynn, because he can. So I think his swimming's really come along. But that said, it hasn't come along so much that he can avoid getting water lodged in his ear, which is now a very dangerous problem that he's about to take on air with him.
The thing that I quite like about this sort of interaction between Alan and Lynn at the beginning is Lynn's cutting sort of quite a frustrated and annoyed figure here. Her tone is very like much of a exasperated mother rather than a personal assistant. And I just, it's just another little slight shift in the dynamic between the two of them. You wouldn't have had this, you wouldn't have had this kind of frustrated, exasperated Lynn in I'm Alan Partridge series one or two. It's just another nice little development of the character and the relationship between the two, I think.
I think the bit I really liked about this opening sequence was the interaction between them at the beginning when Alan says, your eyes go to the left, that's why the man sits there, it's higher status, it's the one thing the hashtag Me Too Brigade haven't cottoned onto yet. I thought that was quite a nice bit of script, kind of mocking, I guess, kind of established media conventions.
Yeah, absolutely. And to Tom Stab's point about Lynn's development as well, I think Alan described her in This Time Series 1 as being the sort of person that kind of grinds on you over time, that eventually, you know, sort of will gradually push you out. And it's almost like that's the relationship here, is that she now can be quite sort of caustic to Alan, you know, like it's almost like she's watching their joint fortunes all tied up in Alan kind of falling by the wayside because she can't get him to do the right thing. And so she's getting more and more frustrated and more forthright with him. And then, I mean, they almost kind of come to blows. I think this is the biggest bust up we've seen of theirs since Alpha Papa, where she starts, she's kind of looks very sort of mean spirited to begin with. And she obviously describes him as barely a summer chicken, let alone a spring chicken. Because of his ear whittle, he mishears this and thinks that she's just called him a summer chicken, and that that is a legitimate insult on its own with no context, which I enjoyed. But then he gets quite mean. He's like, at least I'm not a winter hen who's no longer laying. And then he's like, I take that back. I think you would have had a very interesting take on motherhood. To which she then
I'd like to know more about that.
Yeah. To which she then says, you've had bad breath for 5 years. And he says, yes, and it's your job to keep on top of that. I mean, on the motherhood Lynn thing, obviously, yes, I think she would have had a very interesting take on motherhood. But do we think that if effectively the reason she hasn't settled down and had kids is primarily down to her dedication to Alan? You know, like...
And Christ.
But I imagine there's a situation where she perhaps arranges a date and then has to cancel because Alan needs her to go and run errands for him or pick him up or something.
Adam, she's not even allowed Saturdays off, don't forget.
Exactly.
She's got no time for dating.
She has to be back by 4 p.m. though.
Yeah, so not even a whole day off on a weekend.
So I think it's kind of at least partly down to Alan that she's never had the opportunity to have children.
Yeah, and whilst I don't think they would have been looking to have children, did we ever get resolution on Gordon from I'm Alan Partridge Series 2? I don't think we ever really knew what happened there. Did he die?
There's a reference in Alpha Papa about him having a heart attack, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, and I think Felicity Montague in one of the I'm Alan Partridge director's commentaries or DVD commentaries says that Lynn's organs have dried up. So yeah. I don't even think she could conceive if she wanted to at this point, Lynn.
I mean, my memories of Gordon, he's certainly a man who it looks like he would know his way around high blood pressure. So I'm not surprised that that's how that ended.
Yeah, he's
isn't
absolute...
the thing in Alpha Papa about. About panicking, looking through the letterbox, because there's something in the script about that, which I'm sure was a reference to Gordon dying from a heart attack or something.
Okay.
I'm sure someone will write in and
tell us about 10 King Road and about Gordon dying.
Yeah.
So there's a nice bit of script here, and I guess it goes back to what Susanna Fielding was saying in the interview we referenced recently about there being a musicality to the script. If this had been even... a split second different, it wouldn't have been as funny. And they've obviously engineered it perfectly. The bits where Alan is kind of knows what he's supposed to say, but can't really hear what Jenny said, is sort of tripping over her lines, killing her punchlines, things like that. I thought it was really well done. The bit where she's like, have we got a show for? And then he's like, certainly do.
I didn't hate it, but I did also think I could see this joke coming a mile off, that you were going to have that kind of delayed reaction, missing words, talking over each other type stuff. But I think you're right, like the rhythm of these these bits of script are always so well executed, you can't really hate on it.
I don't know if it's just because I know that it's a project that Steve worked on shortly before this, but I also see a lot of Stan and Laurel in Stan and Ollie in some of the sequences in this series, in terms of the kind of like, there's a sort of like a bit of a kind of end of the pier vaudeville like playfulness to the way that the kind of the sort of turns of phrase and the slapstick approach and that sort of thing. So it does feel like he's lifted some inspiration from some of his other stuff that he's been doing recently. Mm. They also tease the fact that Ellen MacArthur's on tomorrow's show. So which I thought, finally, Alan will get to meet her and give her that pat on the head or the back that he promised. And
great sailing, kiddo.
Yeah, great sailing, kiddo. And it explains why he's got the framed photo in his dressing room as well, potentially, because, you know, she's on the way and he is a fan.
I mean, that's it. I think we'd be led to assume here that Alan has personally pushed for her to be on the show. He's pushed for that booking to happen. Did you spot, just after that, when he's turning round, he just says, there's a shoe in the gantry.
Mm. Yeah.
And that doesn't go anywhere. I thought that was going to be a bit like, there's a shuttlecock up there. There'd be some kind of payoff at the end, but...
I think there's two things. One is, it's very shuttlecocky. It's the shuttlecock of this series. Also, is it just that he's trying to do that thing I'm sure everyone's done when they've had a bit of concealed ear whittle, of sort of trying to tilt his head 90 degrees suddenly to kind of shake it loose, and that's how he spotted that there's a shoe up there?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's happened, but just the fact...
It doesn't have the payoff.
That's in the script. Yeah. It doesn't go anywhere, yeah.
I think that seems odd that there isn't a payoff, because you're right, it is like the shuttlecock thing, and it does seem odd that it doesn't go anywhere.
Just the rich tapestry that is the APU.
But thankfully, argued it's wept, and the ear wiggle is out of his ear and on his shirt. I think Tiff's on the scene at this point, inviting Alan swimming, and alluding to being banned from the pool for a petting incident not 6 months ago.
There was just something awkward conjuring up the imagery of... I don't know how old she's either is in real life or the character is meant to be, but there's just something uncomfortable about petting in a pool. You know, not only is it strictly forbidden along with running, but I just find something awkward about people of middle age being, you know, giving PDAs in public swimming pools.
Yes, yeah, so you're on board with Alan there, because he was going to rebuke a couple for petting. You'd also be doing the same.
I would. I think.
Yeah.
Listen, mate. Don't run. Don't kiss. That's just
no horseplay.
Yeah. Swim safe. Be swim safe. Essentially.
Nick's renowned and very strict no horseplay, no foreplay rule there.
Unless it's in a jacuzzi and the bubbles are on, in which case, you know, hands can wander.
No, I'm just going to stop you there. Wherever you go.
Remind me to never get in a jacuzzi with you.
Jesus.
I do quite like the fact that I think what this episode does in general is kind of move the narrative on a bit. And I mean, we're kind of at episode 5, so narrative should be cracking on a bit by this point. But certainly with Tiff here, you know, we've asked the question in previous weeks, what's her game? What's going on? Is there a kind of longer plan that she's got in mind? Is there trying to be some kind of, you know, is she trying to entrap him? Is she trying to, you know, actually get with him? We don't quite know.
So back to Alan and Jenny, I think, where it's revealed that Alan is Norwich's car laureate, which I absolutely love. The definition of laureate is, I looked it up and it's basically, the word laureate has come to signify eminence or association with literary awards or military glory. It's also used for winners of the Nobel Prize, Gandhi Peace Award and the Student Peace Prize. So obviously being absolutely bastardised here in the case of Alan being Norwich's car laureate. And I love the kind of twist where it's like that... The point of the role is effectively that he's like, I encourage people to make a journey wherever possible by car, which is obviously the invert. Whenever you hear anyone use that kind of wherever possible, they're trying to get people to stop using cars. He's like deliberately doing the reverse, seemingly in return for a discount on any car on the forecourt.
Oh, no, it's a heavy Vauxhall discount he's got.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, yeah. What I also liked about this is because obviously this idea about him being the car laureate was introduced in the Yost House podcast series. So I'm enjoying the Gibbons kind of pulling the Yost House world into the This Time world, just making it feel a lot richer. Kind of everything that's happening in This Time is also happening in the universe of the Yost House, and it's all Alan present day is good.
So he's about to finally get his own back on Ruth in a way. I did enjoy this. I know that people do feel, or certainly people that get in touch with us seem to feel that the Roof segments are repetitive, and I think they can be, but I do think this week it's a bit of a novel twist on it.
I thought it was weak up until a point, and then the kind of rug pull reveal kind of makes me forgive what had just gone before it. If it had just been a standard Ruth Allen section, it would have been quite weak, but the rug pull that it was actually Jenny's notes that Alan was reading saved it, I think. And yeah, like Adam says, it's nice to finally see Alan get one on over Ruth.
Sort of. Yeah. And I also think that Alan will be immensely annoyed that it's grammar that has caught him out, because I think he prides himself on good grammar. So the fact that Ruth has got him on that front, I think, will be frustrating to him, to say the least.
So I was going to say, I'm not actually that convinced the setup of this joke really works if you stop to think about it in much detail. And the good thing is, that's what we're here to do, to discuss everything in far too much detail. Because as this is playing out, so you have things like Frida, who's 80, talking about slashing journey times. Sam, who's 90, saying emissions would be lower than stands to reason. I was thinking, okay, there's something funny going on here. Like, did Alan write these viewer comments or something just didn't quite gel? So then the way the rug pull works is that Jenny doesn't have Alan's script notes per se, because she's got comments phrased like they're from the viewers. So it wouldn't, I mean, this is maybe focusing it too much on how this have to work in reality, because it wouldn't be as simple as an accidental clipboard switch. Like, Alan would have to have carried out some kind of script subterfuge to get these comments in as listener comment, as viewer comments.
That's my understanding is what he's done. He's basically, you know, they've each got a Word doc which has their script notes on it, and he's literally gone into hers and put in some comments of his own as if they're from listeners. Because if you listen back to all of the viewer comments, they've all got Alan's kind of radio patter style.
Yeah, 100%.
They're all written in his cadence.
So I think that's the thing. It's just, I think I was drilling down into this and very much kind of a TV production sort of thing, this just wouldn't happen unless if they're like literally scribbled onto the script in the margins, which also wouldn't really scan. But ultimately, either way, it is an Alan victory and a Ruth defeat, so I'm happy with it. Because it definitely feels like Ruth and Jenny have kind of ganged up on him a little bit so far this series, particularly in episode 3 with the kind of like having the tagging and stuff like that. So it is good that he's had a victory, but if you stop and think about the actual logistical reality behind this kind of switcheroo, I don't think it actually works.
There was a before the kind of rug pull reveal, there was a section where I thought something odd is going on here, not just because Alan was agreeing with all of the Ruth's corrections, but also because the whole topic of the segment is one where he probably would know more than Ruth. Like, it is, you know, it is an area that he probably would know more about, and so for him to be kind of conceding point after point, you could tell something was up before it happened.
Yeah.
I also thought it does show quite a lot of skill for him to pull this off in the middle of a live broadcast. To even be able to kind of carry this many ideas in his head at once, that he's following a script and he knows he switched the notes and he's got to know the right point to reveal that. And, you know, it's. I think we said in a previous episode, there are occasions where he actually is a consummate professional.
I'm not sure you could argue this in being a professional, but he has pulled off something quite intricate.
So it's time for Lynn's news. So she comes over to the sofa and asks Alan, what's the best thing that could ever happen to you? So I thought, question to the group, what is the best thing that could ever happen to you? Who wants to go first?
I can kick off. I've actually got several. It's for the hair on my head to grow back, to meet Matty Healy, and to win the lottery.
Pretty good.
Yeah, it's a decent list. No, it's not a decent list. Two out of three. I'm glad you went with more than one, Nick, because I've actually got three as well.
Liberties.
I mean, initially, I'd have to say hitting the number one spot on the Apple Podcast chart again, that would probably be the best thing that could happen for all of us.
Getting away with that humble brag would be the second thing to happen.
He's done you.
Oh, well, you know, it's mad to think it did actually happen. And then I'd also go, similar vibe to Nick, just winning £1 million. You know, that I'd be quite happy with that. I think that'd be a very, very good thing.
Yeah, mine is a Euro Millions rollover week, though. I'm not settling for £1 million.
Fine, you're going big.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, yeah. And then the other one that I've listed here, because I took inspiration from Alan wanting to win a race, just completing a marathon in less than 4 hours.
Lovely.
It's harder than it sounds.
Thankfully, it really is.
Thankfully, I've also got three. There's a theme recurring here. Number one, a moderate lottery win. Wouldn't want to become a big head. I was thinking probably the set for life 10 grand a week for 30 years would be absolutely fine. secondly, for the pizza cafe in Newton Abbot to add a pizza of my choice to their menu with a title of my choosing.
One of the best things that could ever happen.
Just a point of personal pride.
You've met Adam, right, Tom?
I take it back. I see what.
And finally, for all the people who like to say things like, I tell it like it is, I say it to their face, to realise that it doesn't mean they're good at honesty, it means they're bad at manners.
I think you need to dare to dream big, Adam, because wasn't your like dream weekend away to take Bez to the Isles of Scilly or something?
Not Bez.
Who was it? It was someone like Bez.
I can't remember.
Griff from Super Furries.
Yeah, I think what you've done is you've mistaken not dreaming big with not choosing to take a woman on holiday with you. Just because I'm not using fictitious scenarios to score with like a TV a celebrity.
Adam, how do you know that Sophie Ellis-Bextor hasn't taken up my offer to go to Hawaii?
Because her...
How do we know that hasn't happened? So many reasons.
You're because... right here. So has anyone got Alan's answers?
Oh,
because he's
boy,
got three as well.
Do I? For the hair to grow back on his legs. Do we have any indication why it was lost in the first place?
Is that a thing that happens when you get old?
I think it's a thing. I think it's
a
thing.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think I'm less dense on my legs than I used to be. I think it's a thing. Well, if not, it's just me and Alan.
I know some older men with smooth legs now I'm thinking about it.
listeners, if you're a bit older than us, like maybe in your 50s or 60s, are your legs bald? Get in touch, thepartridgepod@gmail.com.
See, I assume the implication was, you know, it's some kind of weird kind of leg care regime gone awry. Like he's, I don't know, shaved his legs for some weird reason or something like that.
He's dipped them in Veet and it's never come back.
Yeah. But I mean, that's also, I guess the joke is we don't know and it's weird.
The second thing?
To meet Princess Anne.
And finally...
to win a race, which I love because it tells you two things about Alan. One is that he'd be happy to win any race. And,
yep.
And two, by definition, that means he's never won a race of any kind in his entire life.
Which I think figures. I think that's in keeping for the character. Yeah. That's good. But yeah, it's like, is it, you know, is it a running race? Is it a swimming race? Is it a cycle race? Doesn't matter, just any race.
So the big reveal is...
Alan is going to meet Princess Anne.
Yeah, which I quite like the fact that that Lynn says that this will secure your legacy. And that's kind of what was alluded in the Q&A that we watched with the Gibbons and Steve Coogan about how Alan is very aware that, you know, getting to the age that he is and, you know, at the point of the career that he's at the point in his career that he's at, sorry, he's very aware that he needs to cement that legacy or become obsolete. So I think it's quite a nice little nod to what the Gibbons are saying, that they've literally put that in kind of verbatim into the script.
To bastardise a line from The Dark Knight, you either become Wogan or you live long enough to see yourself become Eamon Holmes.
That is a great line. Steve, Rob, Neil, you can have that one.
Use that. So I thought what was really intriguing about this kind of revelation. So obviously we, from Lynn's news, we learn that Alan is going to be interviewing Princess Anne and that Jenny isn't. And I just thought this is clearly, if this is something we're going to get to see play out in the series, which obviously we don't know because we certainly don't see it in this episode. This, I would only imagine this must be foreshadowing some kind of disaster if we're going to get to see this play out. There's no way Alan is going to get to successfully interview Princess Anne the Princess Royal. That's not going to happen, is it?
No way. Not a chance. Not a lifetime.
Yeah, he's going to punch her with a turkeyed hand, isn't he? Or something like that.
At the very least, yeah.
And
yeah.
So he tries to explain to Lynn exactly how this feels. He says, what'll it feel like? Well, for you, imagine you're lying on your side on the sofa about to watch a box set of Judge John Deeds with lots of that dry cake you like. Now times that by 10, how do you feel? And then to that, I would say Lynn makes the most horrendous noise that I've ever heard. and it's so perfectly pitched and so uncomfortable. And it makes Alan feel so uncomfortable because it's like, it's the closest Lynn's ever come to basically making a sexual noise, isn't it?
Oh, God. Ooh, foo, foo, foo. It's horrible. Oh, yeah. I mean, that is kind of, I think, the queasiest I've ever been watching Alan Partridge. And there's been some queas in the past, but this is definitely the queasiest I've ever been.
Also, just on the "this will secure your legacy" line, I thought that's, it's quite Lady Macbeth. And it's also a bit like the bit in Series 1 where he had a quote, "The Omen." It's Dark Lynn again.
I mean, she is basically Lady Macbeth now, isn't she? Her, like you say, Adam, like her success and her failure is so entwined with Alan's success and failure that she has to kind of push him. She has to give him tough love, basically. He is kind of like a mother, a pushy mother sort of thing. Like, she needs him to be at his best at all times because her well-being, and in terms, I guess, financially, and also, you know, her opportunities are so intrinsically linked to Alan. So she does push him a little bit more than she did in the past.
Yeah, she's definitely pulling the strings and sort of pointing him in certain directions. And yeah, yeah.
I'm liking this. Lynn is Lady Macbeth. Yeah.
Mm.
This next intro, although Jenny delivers the initial part, it feels like this is an Alan idea, an Alan conceit that she starts the segment by pretending to be angry that women get to fly planes.
Yeah, it's true, actually. I hadn't really thought of it like that, but now you say it like that, it the way that she delivers that, it suggests that it's something that he's written. Who knows? Maybe this is an extension of the script swapping that we saw earlier in the show.
Hmm. Well, I think there's something that we talked about, the kind of in-character interview that Alan did that was published on the British Comedy Guide, where he did talk about basically there's no real quality control for the show, so he's able to create his own scripts for the autocue and things like that. So I think they've built that into the APU that he would be able to get away with doing that. But I think it's a really good point. I think Jenny wouldn't put something so crass into the script if that was her writing it, would she? Because it is a real kind of like handbrake moment in terms of the tone of the show, like hearing Jenny basically preach outdated views from 1939. But I think it's worth it for Alan's line, "Don't worry, those aren't Jenny's views. She's not Anne Widdecombe." I thought that was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And also there's a bit where Alan sort of claims that they had to put off equality to deal with fascism first. You can only tackle one concept at a time. And then a nice bit where Jenny sort of ends the segment by saying, you know, we're now going to go and hear from these brave band of women who helped us win the war. And Alan can't help but add, "Although not in combat roles."
Okay, it's time to talk about Alan in a Spitfire. I don't know about you guys, but I was very excited to see this week. We've known this has been coming. It's been in the credits all series, Alan in a Spitfire. And yeah, so we could tell about probably just over a week ago from press images that this was going to be the episode where we got to see how this all played out. What did you guys think? Did this live up to your expectations?
I'm going to start by saying yes and no. I would just like to start with just a quick note on Alan's outfit. He obviously knows he's going to fly a Spitfire. So what has he done? He's gone and find his sort of like most Biggles rides again or flies again jacket. And he's got aviators on. Of course he's got aviators on. And I reckon he would definitely have just gone and purchased those for the purposes of this VT.
I'd actually say it's Biggles meets Top Gun, isn't it? It's a bit of both, yeah. And he's got leather gloves on, but not the string back leather driving gloves this time.
I feel like as well, Top Gun from the 80s, and Alan's sort of choice of fashion is generally 80s based, so it works well. I also thought, to your point about, oh, you know, we knew this was coming, there was a bit of me though that thought, we've seen bits in the intro where we almost haven't seen it referenced, so part of me was like, will we actually get to see it? So it is nice that it's kind of come to fruition.
Yeah, this isn't him dancing with the lady. Like, this is the real deal. Yeah. Yeah.
It would be, the BBC would have to have paid quite a bit of money to get Alan to go and fly a Spitfire and then to not use the footage.
True.
That'd be the absolute trolling from the Gibbons brothers. Like, yeah, we're going to go and film this and it's going to be 2 seconds in the intro sequence and never seen again.
In the same way that... Coogan kind of just quite likes to go around really nice hot countries and eat all the really nice food with his mate Rob Brydon, maybe Coogan rolls into the production meeting and is just like, oh, I fancy flying a Spitfire this series. Are we going to use the footage?
I do feel a bit like the production budget of this time, if you strip out talent fees, or should I say Steve's fee, must be relatively small, but I reckon this VT must like have trebled, quadrupled the production budget of what this time's like entire series one budget must have been.
If any of our listeners out there has ever flown a Spitfire or flown in a Spitfire, how much did it cost?
It's actually, we've had a few people over the last few weeks comment on how it's quite interesting. Some of the subject matter of each episode has been quite on the money in terms of kind of what's in the news agenda that week, which obviously, like, you know, these shows were filmed like in November, December last year. It's quite bizarre because even like the Spitfire and kind of the chat we get into later about the kind of like the left wing agenda and stuff, it's quite interesting because even just like having things that I've seen on Twitter today, like kind of there's a bit of another kind of culture war around kind of like the use of the flag and kind of jingoism. And I think there was like a typhoon like with the Union Jack on it and stuff. So Alan in a Spitfire above the White Cliffs of Dover and talking about left wing people and stuff is like, again, quite on the money for like the conversation in the ether on social media and stuff this week.
What? Yeah, didn't they unveil that plane with the Union Jack painted on it? Is that a typhoon, that plane that they announced?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually just one that's like a display thing. That's not like what all typhoons are going to look like, because obviously they wouldn't have camouflage, but still, like, you know.
I wonder whose plane that might be.
Exactly, but again, like, I think there's like a new design for like the what was like the European health card or the global health card, which is, again, used to just be blue and now is like a Union Jack. So it's like, again, Alan, Spitfire, White Cliffs of Dover, World War II, jingoism, kind of left-wing rebuttal. Like, it's all there. It's all in the mix. And we know exactly, like, they know what they're doing with that sort of stuff, I think.
What I'm hearing, chaps, is why did we bother winning the war? That's what I'm hearing.
That's exactly it, yes.
What I would quickly say, I just rifled through some notes here. And on costings, I took my dad in a Lancaster bomber, which just drove around an airstrip, so we didn't take off.
You just drove it.
That was £350 PP for two of us, so that was £700, and we didn't even leave the ground. So
wow.
You've got to think this is going to be quite expensive. Bear in mind they were doing loop-de-loops on the White Cliffs of Dover.
Brilliant.
So I do quite like the opening of this VT where Alan, you know, does the old kind of rug pull of who was the person who flew the plane and who was the person who did the stayed at home doing the stitching, and, you know, blaming that the man was mollycoddled by his mother and grew up to be a softie.
Yeah. that did make me laugh.
Yeah, I like that the term softy kind of says so much and says so little at the same time. And also softy, I feel like, is a bit of a kind of like pejorative from days gone by. No one calls anyone a softy these days.
It's definitely a kind of insult that Alan would use.
Yeah. It kind of sounds like a sort of a wartime kind of almost like insult, you've used it kind of years ago.
So is it time to meet Eleanor Hartley?
Oh, and the stunning special effects work that goes along with it.
Is it because they've blown the budget on the Spitfire and they're like, this is all we can afford? Or is it?
Actually, and this has just occurred to me, I mean, obviously, the joke is very much that the effects work is terrible, and it did really make me laugh when they did it. But, like, when you think about, in this time series one, when you had school child Alan, which was like a fully composite, like, graphic recreation, like, I like that they kind of run the gamut of what potentially the BBC working with Pear Tree Productions are capable of. And in this week, it was not very good.
Yeah, I think definitely put a photo up on the socials of Eleanor's face, older, younger face superimposed onto her current face.
And there were kind of two shots. So there was one main shot where obviously it's very prominent. And then wasn't there like another like slightly wider shot when it was there for like a split second? The superimposed face like disappeared, didn't it?
Could get rid of it in the edit.
Nah.
please remember that Eleanor is a wonderful, wonderful woman. and then Alan proceeds to talk over her the entire interview.
I did rifle through the internet, that's right, rifle through the internet, to see who potentially the character was kind of based on in real life. And obviously there's lots of articles of women participating within the war in various different forms, but I feel like potentially the character was based on a Mary Ellis, who was a British ferry pilot and one of the last surviving British women pilots from the Second World War. So not entirely sure if that's the case or who they based it on, but potententally that is who this is focused on.
It's a good find. You've done some research, Nick, so we can't complain.
Guys, it's what I do. It's sometimes what I do.
Better. Yeah. Should we talk about Roger That, aka Paul Wheeler?
This very much reminded me of the joke in Scissored Isle where he goes to meet store manager David Paul, and there's that kind of muddling of the names. It's kind of a similar joke that we've seen before, but again, executed in a different way, and I thought executed very, very well.
Yeah, I thought it was good. Have you guys done any research into the actor that played him as well? I thought he looked quite familiar, but I think I was perhaps thinking somebody else.
I didn't recognise him at all, to be honest. So if you have research, I'd love to hear, because I didn't even recognise him, to be honest.
I thought it was somebody else, and I couldn't even tell you who I thought it was. But I am pleased to report, looking at Wikipedia, he has been in Casualty, Holby City, and The Bill. He's been in the Holy Trinity of UK television. So if only I had the bell that I could ring. Fair play. His real name, and I'm probably going to mangle the pronunciation, is Christopher Colquhoun. I mean, I'd probably pronounce that wrong. That's Colquhoun. So great work, Chris.
Nice. Yeah, welcome to the Partridge APU.
Yeah.
Would you need to go on multiple trips to the toilet if you were going to fly a Spitfire?
Yes.
I think I probably would as well, especially if I was going to loop-de-loop it several times. I think I would definitely need to go to the toilet, which I'm told by experts is completely normal, by the way.
Completely normal. I do like the fact that, Alan asks what it was like for women like Eleanor to carry such responsibility in the Second World War effort. I mean, she's right there. He could literally just ask her. But no, he has to ask the man. what was it like for the woman? And also, her face is just kind of cut up on the
framing is the gag within the gag, isn't it? That she's cut out of the screen completely.
Well, that's what I was going to say. She totally sidelined, like, kind of like metaphorically and literally in terms of how this is filmed. I thought that was very good.
Yeah, and also, please, the only way for Alan to understand what it's like is to fly the Spitfire. Not ask Eleanor, fly the Spitfire.
That's obviously, that's the gag you can see coming a mile off for this whole VT. It's like, yes, this whole segment exists purely as an exercise for Alan to have an excuse to fly a plane or be flown in a plane, yeah.
So after the handful of toilet trips, Alan's in the air.
He's pretty happy from the off, and to be fair, I can see why. I would personally absolutely love to fly in a Spitfire. I mean, it looked fairly rickety as it was going up in the air, but I think I'd be pretty happy going up in a Spitfire, to be totally honest.
I liked that there's a point when it looked to me like he was going to black out, or I thought he was either going to pass out or like throw up on himself or something, but then it kind of, I think, completes the loop, and then he's just like grinning like an absolute maniac and he's loving it.
In the same way that we did the four faces of Alan for the OBBC, My BBC, I think four different faces of Alan in the Spitfire is going to have to go up on the socials, isn't it?
Yeah. And he almost kind of defaults back to that almost childlike kind of enthusiasm, where at first he's kind of scared of the loop-de-loop, and he's like, I want to do it again, similar to kind of the Joe Beasley and Cheeky Monkey, where he's like, he's behind you, he was literally behind you. It's that kind of like almost like childlike mentality with him kind of enjoying, being sort of trepidatious at first and then enjoying it and asking to sort of be doing it again, like when a father sort of pushes a child on a swing and goes, higher daddy, higher.
It's exactly that. He says, spin me again, please, I think, after he's finally not going to black out and he's loving it. I thought there was, like, initially I was a bit like, okay, like, you know, this purely exists, the gag is the woman that knows about this is sidelined, this is purely for Alan to go in a plane and that is the gag. But I actually think when you spend a bit more time, there's actually quite a lot going on here, because the things when he starts going on about up here, you can be proud to be British, no left-wing people can tut at you, I just thought, there's actually a lot of detail going in into the script here, but it's kind of, you can definitely miss it, because if you're focusing on the spectacle of Alan Partridge in a Spitfire, some of the nuance can definitely pass you by, I think. Because he's even talking about cultural appropriation because he's wearing a fez, and he's like, only because I'd gone dressed as Tommy Cooper. Just little details like that I thought were great.
Yeah, there's also a bit, I'm not sure if you spotted it, because it was sort of, it reminded me of that moment, I think was it in last week's episode, where with the SAS, where he falls over slightly at the end
of
a couple of weeks, where he falls over at the end of the shot. Mm. There's a sort of a moment here where he's talking and he references himself as a journalist. Did anyone pick up on that?
And it's
kind of describing himself as a journalist. Well, what I would say is a TV journalist. I did enjoy that Alan is now kind of seeing himself in that league where he's now a journalist.
And I think that's interesting on a few levels, because obviously we've heard him talking about like Jenny being seen as a journalist or a TV journalist, and he talks about that with quite some disdain, I think. But I was also going to say, I think some of the real gems in this time, I think, exist when you can make out the dialogue underneath the voiceover. I think the Gibbons and Steve are quite good at literally multi-layering like the actual script. So you need to kind of watch at least twice to get the voiceover script and then the dialogue underneath it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like in the Oast House where he makes the fake 999 call and then he starts talking over it and he goes, I have to inform you at this point, this is just a prank phone call.
So yeah, Alan recreates the Battle of Britain.
So long, Fritz.
So in general, I thought this VT section was pretty good. I mean, I did think it went on a little bit long. I think there could have been a little bit of bits and bobs that could have been cut. The safety check bit, not that great, but I guess it sets up the gag of, you know, him going to the toilet multiple times, which is perfectly normal. I feel there's a little bit that could have been trimmed. I thought it was solid.
The other note I had about the safety check bit, when they're talking through the steps he has to do, and one of them is to unplug the radio, and he says, oh, I don't want to do that. So I think that's great, because obviously in his mind he's thinking about radio is broadcast medium, I love radio, I'm a broadcaster, I don't want to unplug a radio. And he's not thinking about, no, it's a communications device that attaches you to the plane.
Yeah, I agree. And I do think that, to your point, Tom Stab, the VT was stronger, and certainly one of the strongest we've seen, if not the strongest, but just a bit of trimming would have probably elevated it slightly. I do think that once he's in the plane, it goes on a little bit too long. But overall, enjoyable.
I think that's because he's being spun round again.
Like trainers in a washing machine.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So coming out of the Spitfire section, I like that Alan is so distracted by how much fun he had making it that he repeats Jenny's exact point, and is also ignoring the voice of a woman while talking about the sacrifices made by women, which I thought was was very Alan, and a really nice bit of writing as well.
I thought that was great. I initially thought like maybe that was like a play on his hearing still being blocked, but obviously the ear widdle's come out, so it's not that. And like you say, it's the male host ignoring what the female host has just said. But it also really reminded me of, do you remember in The Fast Show, there was an character played by Arabella Weir, where she'd just be stood there like going, can anybody hear me? While she suggests something and then all the men repeat it.
Oh, yeah.
It's exactly that sort of gag, which is really brilliant. But him like saying, I had such a good time. He says that twice as well as repeating Jenny's line.
So we're talking about trolls. I mean, this is a slightly weird bit in that it feels like it would have been a section where it would be natural to link it back to High Noon in From the Oast House, but obviously there's no reference made to that at all. So Alan then leaves himself a voice note to make sure that he get Lynn to book a cleaner for the shingles, his cottage. I like that because it's called The Shingles, it sort of implies the disease rather than just the pebbles.
I like this, that it's just us getting to see the modern version of Alan's dictaphone as well, which has been so infamous across the years. It's now a voice note. Makes sense.
Paints a bit of colour around Alan as a character and tells you something that you kind of already knew, that he's the sort of person that would buy a second home in Cornwall. There's been lots of films and news articles lately about how many people are doing that and how it's sort of tearing the heart out of the Cornish community. But also, he's very pleased with his house because it's in a copse in a conservative constituency, which I think is just, you know, that's Alan through and through.
A little bit of paradise.
But before we get into the interview with Jenny's troll, I thought... Alan, when he's talking about that he's going to be there, but in a camper van at the end of the garden. And I thought that really made me think of, obviously, I'm Alan Partridge series 2. He's in the Static Home. And at the end of that series, when he's moved into the house, he basically ends up arranging everything, like all of his possessions, into one room in exactly the same layout as the Static Home. So this is kind of like a nice through line here. So he's got this kind of, this luxurious second home in Cornwall, but he's staying there in a camper van at the end of the garden. It's like he can't move on from staying somewhere that is essentially a static home.
Did anyone else think it was a bit odd that he's offered Jenny the use of this cottage? I sort of felt like they don't really have that level of friendship, even if it was available.
I think that, you know, when you think about things in series one where, you know, he offers to lasagna with her once a week, he is desperate, or keen, should I say, to have her in his life. And I think that not only would he enjoy it from a relationship perspective, but I also think it probably gives him a sort of position of power in some respect if he's able to kind of, you know, offer Jenny something, you know, like that.
I feel like he's trying to do it in part to kind of be helpful and supportive, but obviously there's another large part where he's ever hopeful that something might become a romantic liaison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I guess, and especially when you think back to, like, during the drinks tasting with Rosie Witter, when he was sort of imagining her getting a bit tipsy and throwing three sheets to the wind and basically becoming someone who he could feasibly have a relationship with.
I mean, in essence, he's hedging his bets. He's inviting Tiff, he's inviting Jenny. He's just hoping something's going
to
work out.
He didn't invite Tiff, to be fair. Tiff invited herself. No.
Yeah, good point. He's still hedging his bets. He's still keeping him in the balance.
I just hope that John Kawasaki doesn't need it that weekend. But I'm jumping ahead.
I like the bit about this time being a family. Alan's dad, Jenny's mum, and then Simon chimes in to say troublesome son. To which Alan replies, "Well, troubled son." So they've launched a cyber safe campaign, which I thought was great and very typical of shows like The One Show, where the name of the campaign is already quite dated. Cyber safe is the sort of thing you would have heard people pitching as a title, you know, maybe 10 years ago
when they're surfing the internet superhighway,
exactly.
Something like that. Yeah. So the first note I had here, when the troll Bhavit Sharma is kind of like, you get Alan's reaction here, the way Alan is looking at him, like as Jenny's introing him, is incredible. He's properly looking, like literally looking down his nose at him. I thought that was great.
Well, I thought it was sort of very alpha male, like the way he spreads himself on the sofa, putting his arms sort of around Jenny, protecting her. It's a very kind of subconscious thing that an alpha male would do, where he's just like, I'm going to spread myself and make myself look as big as possible and sort of like own this person because they've targeted Jenny. Again, it's kind of like a link to the fact that Alan is maybe in some way protective of her or wants to help her, but also, you know, wants to feel like she needs him. Obviously she doesn't in any way, shape or form, but it's just another element of this kind of world building around Alan kind of wanting Jenny in whatever form he can get her, I guess.
Hopefully, some other listeners will have noticed that this is a further expansion of the overlap between Staffelet's Flats
yes.
And Partridge, in that Bhavit Sharma is played by Nick Mohammed, who is Anthony Stappen Lettings in Staffelet's Flats. You might also know him as Malcolm in Drifters, and in fact he's been in loads of stuff. He's got 61 credits on IMDb, so a bit player in loads of really great comedies and shows.
Ted Lasso, probably most recently, is quite the prominent thing he's been in as well.
And he's appeared in loads of things like Night of the Apollo, or whatever it's called, the thing at Hammersmith Apollo, and he has a character called Mr. Swallow that he's done for years and years and years that kind of pops up on stand-up shows and comedy shows, etc. So yeah, I think he had a Sky show with
David Schwimmer.
Geller. Can't think of David Schwimmer. Yeah.
So I was going to say that this bit overall, I think for me, was probably the weakest section of the episode.
Yeah,
I thought there might be something a bit cleverer going on with the writers having a pop at trolls and kind of social media criticism, and I thought there might be a bit more of a pointed payoff. And like you said, Adam, I was thinking it might even tie in with High Noon somehow. So a bit disappointed it didn't really get there. However, what I did like is Alan trying to be like super protective of Jenny and then smashing her in the face with a bunch of flowers and then just like saying things like, is it symmetrical? Gun to my head? Probably not, but it's mainstream. So he ends up basically trolling her while she sat right next to her. So I thought that bit was quite fun. But I think overall in the episode, this is probably the bit which I thought kind of it had the least payoff to it for me, I think.
I did like the switch that occurs towards the end where Alan realises he might actually be able to get something out of this guy, and that is a classic car for 20 grand versus 26 grand.
Yeah.
Negotiating a discount on live television.
I guess I like the theme through this is a bit one note, but that Alan basically, is, as Nick said, misjudged the whole tone of the segment. He thinks that, you know, you get this person on, it's a classic red top tabloid naming and shaming. It's humiliating and embarrassing him and forcing him to apologise. But what you actually get, of course, is like quite a meek guy who didn't really mean it, is very contrite, has come on because he's sorry. And so that kind of like gotcha journalism doesn't really work, because he's already apologized, he's already sorry, and obviously then the joke is that Alan effectively does more damage than Bhavit Sharma ever did by basically saying a load of derogatory things about Jenny on national TV.
A shrinking violet, she ain't. Is it time for Simon's very first item?
Yes, I was quite proud of Simon when he did this as well. I was kind of willing him on to do well. I think it was good to see.
Yeah, we've kind of seen this in the past. From series one in episode six, where Jenny storms off the set and Simon ends up sort of parachuting in.
Julia.
He is actually a better presenter than you would think, and is very competent and can hold it his nerve on live television, which I think is actually kind of the main thing that annoys Alan the most. Not only is he sort of muscling in on his territory, but he's also actually quite good at it. And that obviously annoys Alan, because he doesn't want anyone sort of usurping him, especially when he's, getting on a bit and he wants to secure his legacy. He doesn't need a younger person coming in and doing a better job than him.
There's a very subtle bit, which I like to think is intentional and a skilled bit of writing, that when Jenny introduces Simon introducing the item, she mentions that he leaves her tickled pink, which I thought was a nice nod back to in the first series where Alan's, he says, I'd like to tickle you pink by accident to her. And it also sort of subtly introduces the idea that Simon is doing the things that Alan wishes he could, especially in terms of like Jenny and her
nice.
Reaction.
Yeah.
That's really good. I'm liking that, Adam. I'm liking that a lot. I was going to say it's so pointed how much Alan hates the fact that Simon is basically starting to climb the ladder of kind of like success within the show, I guess, because he says things like it does look odd. And he also says Simon's on holiday at the sofa, but he lives at the Digiwall. So it's kind of a very literal, like get back in your box or get back to the Digiwall. And equally, I wonder whether this is trying to indicate something about Jenny in that kind of like ruthlessness that we've talked about before. She is definitely quite patronizing about Simon in this. So she's supportive, but then she does also say things like, that was so good. And didn't he do a good job? So it is treating him a bit like a kind of like little kid with a pat on the head. So I think they're both a bit wary about Simon becoming like a new presenter and then taking a bit of shine away from them.
Alan complains that that Simon's VT is in black and white, but the film being reenacted, Rear Window, was in colour. Now, if you actually look into this, Rear Window was originally filmed in black and white, but was actually restored to colour. So Alan is wrong, and Simon was right to make it black and white. So
brilliant.
Yeah, Alan thinks he's outsmarted Simon there, but the truth is that actually Simon's in the right and Alan's in the wrong.
You know what? I did think, I wonder whether there was a gag in there, and then I just forgot to look it up. So good job
you
did.
That's why there's four of us.
There's also a bit towards the end where you can, I think there's a sort of sense of pride where Simon wants to impress Alan, even though he doesn't get anything from Alan. It's almost like the sort of affection of a father that he's kind of seeking the approval of. So he kind of says to Alan, oh, this is a good bit. And you just see Alan literally just walk straight off, which we've seen a couple of times where he'll invite Simon almost to speak about things that are personal to him. So we've seen it in Mid-Morning Matters where he talks about, you know, looking for his, you know, his family, because obviously we know that Simon is adopted, and Simon will start to talk about it and Alan will just cut him off. So it kind of really reminded me of something similar to that, where, you know, Simon's proud of a good bit that's coming in the VT, but oh no, Alan just walks off and ignores it.
So tragically, it doesn't look like Tiff's going to be able to come to Cornwall after all, because as Alan claims, there are some Japanese businessmen from Japan who are coming that might invest in his production company. And I think if you're looking closely, as soon as he says they're Japanese for the second time in one sentence, that's the point where she knows this is bullshit. Even before he gets to the fact that they're called John Kawasaki and John Suzuki, to which she says John Yamaha couldn't make it. And then ends the segment by just saying, don't dick me about.
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting that she knows he's bullshitting her, but she doesn't care. So it's still, I'm much like Stab has been for the last 2 weeks, I'm really buying into the intrigue of where this relationship between the two of them is going to end up. And we also do get a really lovely, very, very, very long laugh at the end of this section as well.
So back to Simon, we're just coming out of the back of his first VT. He was so close to doing well, but then fluffed it by giving out the real names and addresses of the people that he met. Which, I mean, obviously they had to have him fuck something up, but I actually felt this was the writing didn't quite work. I feel like it's so forced, the way that he reads out their full addresses, that it's not even an error that he would have really made. I found it quite hard to sort of believe, even in the APU, that he would make this fuck up. Because he had to sort of go out of his way to say their addresses out loud.
Yeah, I guess it's another one where, kind of as Tom was saying earlier about having to, you know, the practicalities of would this happen, you maybe have to give it a bit of creative license for the gag to work. But I know what you mean. It feels that the payoff isn't strong enough when you consider the sort of amount of creative license you have to give the gag to sort of buy into it.
Yeah, it just felt like this is one of the points where the writing became a little bit too much tell and not enough show, if you know what I mean. It was just a bit too, like, they're really putting it in front of you.
Yeah, because it's just achieving the point to kind of, it's a way for Alan to remind Simon that he actually doesn't know how everything works. So it's, again, continuing that, like, get back in your box. But I hadn't really thought about it, but I think you're right. I'm sure there could have been a better way they could have achieved that.
Yeah, I think so. By then, you know, by saying that, they do immediately do that bit where Alan refers back to knowing how things work, which is something that Simon said earlier. You know, I've been here for a while and I'm starting to know how things work. And so, yeah, I mean, that bit of writing felt a lot cleaner and made more sense.
And can I just double check the three core artists to reference when talking about rock and roll, that this should be Billy Bragg, Beyonce and Bruce Springsteen? That is correct, isn't it? Those are like the three main rock and roll artists, right?
I did enjoy as well when we hear Beyonce, Alan gives a massive eye roll and then an immediate thumbs up. I'm not sure if anyone clocks that.
I didn't spot that.
Oh, it's so good. So Jenny says Billy Bragg, Beyonce, and at that point the biggest eye roll and then an immediate thumbs up to kind of like, oh, got to correct that, so it just goes in with a thumbs up. I say that is well worth going back and have a rewatch. It's very good.
I also like just before they move on, Alan goes, Bruce Springsteen, that's another one, 4 decades singing about guys in overalls. Give it a rest.
Give it a rest.
that was good. So the band coming up is called Cayman, and I'm assuming that's, you know, a not too subtle reference to the Cayman Islands, the notorious tax haven.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, and the band features Alex Owen, who's one half of comedy duo The Pin. Tom Dart's a big fan of The Pin.
Can I just talk about The Pin a minute? So just for the listeners to understand. So for me, I think The Pin is like the best radio sketch comedy in years and years. I've been telling the other three guys to listen to it for years and they don't bloody listen to me. It's honestly, it's brilliant. It all centers around puns and wordplay. It's all on BBC Sounds.
I don't remember.
Just give it a listen. It's really great. Like these guys haven't bothered.
Don't remember.
Yeah. Do yourself a favor and go and give that a listen. Do that.
You're Mark Kermode talking about The Exorcist. We're Simon Mayo not giving a shit.
Well, I've enjoyed great comedy and you're missing out.
Can I just say, Nick, I really enjoyed that.
Alex Owen's also the star
Bloody
of...
Bloody flappy hands now as well.
Alex Owen's also the star of Petrichor, a web series that featured a lot of people who are also in this, like Lolly Adefope's in it, and Eddie White's in it, I think, as well. So again, the Stafflets Flats Petrichor Partridge crossover is strong.
Partridge Core.
What I quite liked about this whole... I liked it and I didn't like it. About this whole sketch, obviously they're doing the thing that, you know, again... mainstream BBC One shows or similar shows will do, where they talk about bands in very sort of hackneyed, dated terms. But I thought, even by those standards, if this was like something that was on the One Show, these terms are dated from the writers of Partridge's point of view. Whereas I think they're probably terms that like the Gibbons or Steve might use in real life that themselves are dated. So these terms that they use, like stacks of attitude, mad, bad and dangerous to know, right on, knockout, etc. They're almost too dated to even be dated, if that makes sense. Like they're like two generations dated.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. It's like...
I think it's fine, though. I think ultimately it's like, you know, you're totally right. Like when you look at something like The One Show as a comparison point, it is always that thing. It's like... When they seldom have like a music act on, you know that the presenters don't really know who they are or whatever it might be, and it's just going with whatever they think is like the most relevant.
I get the point they're making. I just think like some of these phrases are genuinely the way that bands were introduced in like the 50s, you know?
I think that's deliberate though. I don't think that's...
Because the conceit of The One Show is that they would have script writers who would write these lines for Jenny and Alan to say... to make them relatable to the people who are watching the show at home. And they would be people in their between 50s and 70s, probably, I'd imagine. So, you know, their references for what rock music is that it is dangerous and anti-establishment, because the dangerous and anti-establishment rock bands of when they were sort of, you know, coming out of their... moving into coming out of young adulthood into proper adulthood would have been bands like punk bands and, you know, maybe even like, you know, New Romantics, which aren't dangerous, but they are, you know, quite outlandish and, I don't know, anti-establishment, I guess.
But I think the thing is, it's like, one, I could picture this is script that Alan's written, like, because it is so kind of like off key and like not with the times. But also I think the joke also works because obviously this band is not mad or bad or dangerous to know whatsoever.
He does have red trousers.
They're an absolute bunch of posh sods with plums in their mouths. And yes, Tom, all three of the guys in the band have red trousers on, which is a classic kind of posh guy stereotype, which I thought was a very good little visual gag in that.
Cosmo, Oscar and Felix.
That's the ones.
Just leaving Juno.
And also, I was going to say, what I thought was absolutely brilliant writing here was when Alan says, watching that VT was the first time I've ever heard or seen you. That's so on the money. Like, one, for Alan as the character that we know doesn't prep, doesn't research his guests, but also in-house shows like this work. The presenters don't know who's, like, all the details of the people that are coming on, particularly when it comes to music. Like, you know, look at Sunday Brunch and the Dead Eyes of Tim Lovejoy. He doesn't know what musician's coming on. He hasn't listened to the music. He's just got an auto cue with some questions on it. That's how this world works, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow. I feel like you're tearing down my Sunday Brunch experience.
I loved the bit of hypocrisy when Cosmo says that, you know, they're doing what they're doing rather than dropping our H's and T's in an effort to fit in. Like, it's like, all right, you will drop your T's for D's.
Did anybody have any kind of notes to share about the song, The Cotswold Commuter?
Yeah, only that it seemed to be kind of like an inverse Common People by Pulp, but not as good. And that it effectively is just a list of posh things, isn't it, really? It's not particularly credible lyrically as a song.
No, but I think for the gag it worked, because that's kind of the point, isn't it? Like, these are just like a bunch of posh kind of kids that formed an indie band that is somehow kind of inexplicably become successful and annoyed lots of people in the process. And I did think when you kind of then get into like this second part of this where the streakers and the protesters appear, and I don't know about you guys, but that genuinely caught me off guard when it happened.
Yeah, the intro, when this kicks off, it was obviously quite reminiscent of Shona McGough from Knowing Me, Knowing You. Is it the first episode? No, maybe. Is it the first episode? I think it might be the first episode.
Rock and Roller, so we'll have a pair.
Exactly. It's quite reminiscent of that, but then it goes in a slightly different direction. So I'm glad that it wasn't just a straight-up knockoff of that, basically.
Yeah, and I thought, particularly the bit when they go and it cuts to black and they cut the sound, you know, that really reminded me of the first time watching, like, when he shot Forbes McAllister. There's suddenly that kind of bit of realism of kind of like, oh, what would happen in this scenario? So I actually really liked this whole section because it just reminded me, like, you know, it's almost a bit of a Bill Grundy Sex Pistols moment, like these kind of like crazy TV things that happen, but that kind of chaos linking so well to what we've seen from the Knowing Me, Knowing You world, whether it's Shona McGough, whether it's Forbes McAllister. So it really felt like it was another one of those moments in the APU. So I liked it.
Less a question to the group and more just a question to Tom. As someone who works in TV and has been around these sorts of scenarios, if this was to happen in real life, would they stay on air or would they cut to like one of those holding card things or like their technical difficulties sort of thing?
Oh yeah, I think they'd just cut. I don't think they'd risk like what happens here because it's so unpredictable.
They certainly wouldn't allow someone to say, please stop running. I will not allow you to portray this as some kind of Benny Hill tittle-tattle. It just takes one person to speed up the footage and send it to Yakety Sax.
I absolutely love that. Yeah. That really, really made
me laugh.
As he
runs past as well.
Hang on a minute. Can we, little challenge to the listeners here. Can somebody get that footage of Alan running around the studio, speed it up and add it to Yakety Sax?
Please do. Brilliant. There's quite a lot of BBC bashing in this very quick segment. And I know we've talked a little bit about how risque it is or isn't for the writers to include bashes to the BBC. But in the space of a few minutes, Alan says, there are things the BBC will no longer allow, smoking in soap operas, criticism of the government, and of course, topless Ooh. Women who don't live in a rainforest, which I thought was really good, quite pointed. And they obviously sort of slipped that in a joke sandwich. They put their real point in the middle there, which I thought was really good.
That's really good. I feel like we should watch out for that more. The Gibbons joke sandwich. Yeah. That's a good concept.
It's a new concept. And yeah, Alan's obviously trying to balance sort of post Me Too gender politics with shutting down the protest. Previously, he would have just like pushed them off stage. They also have someone shouting out, fuck the system, fuck the BBC, in the middle of, back to the real world here, in the middle of a programme going out about 9:45 p.m. on BBC One on a Friday night, which I thought was, maybe that's the first time that's ever happened.
It's good to hear, but, and like we have talked about this a bit over the weeks, like, I'm really impressed that the Gibbons have gone for some of these kind of jokes that poke fun at the BBC and kind of the establishment around it. It's like, you know, I'm impressed that the Gibbons and Steve have written these jokes and that the BBC have gone, yes, we're going to let you keep these in the scripts. I think fair play.
Just before we come on to the subtitles, I just want to say there's obviously a lot of good jokes and fun ideas, novel ideas with subtitles here. But to give him his due, and we don't do it often enough, producer Jed is one of the people behind a short horror film called Dawn of the Deaf, which I would say, if you've got 20 minutes, go and watch it. I think it's on Vimeo. Jed can insert himself plugging his film here.
We can share a link as well.
Yeah, but there are some genuinely incredible inventive ideas around subtitles in that short film, and this really made me think of the fact that producer Jed has actually done this A, earlier, and B, better.
Can I say, I'll tell you what, we're going to go one better, Jed. We'll put a link to it in the show notes as well. There we go. So that will be there forevermore.
Yeah. So we're coming...
Finally, the payback after 5 years of editing our crap.
We are coming towards the end of this episode. So listeners, when you finish listening to this episode, head straight to the show notes, go straight to the description, and you'll see the link in there. Do yourself a favour, click on that link.
It's also worth saying, I mean, I feel like people should know that that Jed not only produces Monkey Tennis, which is obviously his finest and best work, but he's also the mastermind behind Host, the award-winning horror movie that's been all over the interwebs and all over everything the last few years. So credit where it's due. He's basically a minor celebrity.
Well, maybe
I think he's going to absolutely fall off his chair when he hears this.
He? Well, I don't think we can include a link to Host because it's on a subscription platform, but maybe we can post a link to the trailer in the show notes so people can watch that and then go and find it if they would like to see more. But I would highly, highly recommend Host.
He didn't even pay us to say that. Terry on camera two is lapping up the nudity, trying to get everybody to pull away from the protesters, but they cannot get Terry to stop filming.
I absolutely love that. I think there were two bits. So after we've had the subtitles and they're kind of like back in full vision, full audio, the camera two, Terry, sort it out, mate. So when he says, do you want to give it a try and play Beat the Redactor? Those two lines really, really made me laugh.
I also love the bit where he briefly entertains getting a clip mic onto the protester but has to go for a boom because she hasn't got any clothes to clip it onto. There's also a point where I think that there's a bit of a monologue where the phrase titillate lonely middle-aged men comes on. Mm-hmm. And the camera points directly to Alan during that bit.
I love that bit.
Well, I think the way that kind of pans out is you end up like he's kind of like eyeballing the camera. So it's, you know, it's, yeah, the implication is very clear what they're doing there.
I also think the bit where he's inviting the protester to beat the redactor by basically shuffling from side to side would be ridiculous, but the intent and the seriousness on her face really sells it. And I feel like they might not have got away with something quite so silly, but she looks like she's genuinely trying to like beat the system by basically getting out of the way of the redactors.
I mean, you're so right. Like, you know, there are so this end section is weird because it is a return to kind of silliness and slightly more slapstick place that we're not often in the world of Alan, but. Yeah, I don't know. It works for me, but I could equally see a lot of people not liking it, and I would also understand that. Because I think actually what works is quite a nice counterpoint to the kind of silliness and the slapstick nature here is it's then all grounded in a conversation, a discussion around neoliberalism and global capitalism, which then becomes fun because all he can really end up saying is the world's effed up big styly. He describes the protesters as having fizz and vim, which, again, it's just like, it's trying to... He can't make reference points that actually sit where they need to. So like you were saying, like when they're talking about introing the band and stuff, it's like he can't ground himself in like the world of 2021. Like, who describes people as having fizz and vim? And I also just love the fact that, in essence, Alan's totally floundering in this situation, whereas Jenny is able to engage and kind of like direct the debate and actually kind of like rein it all in a bit.
Yeah, and I think there's, again, this is a sort of maybe a smart kind of piece of writing on the Gibbons part, whereby it's also a bit of a subtle nod to where we are in the culture war of 2021, where, you know, it's extremes on both sides, whether it's, you know, the protesters or Cayman. So I also think there's a little bit of a subtle nod and a wink to just the world that we're living in 2021 that's well observed.
I like that in his own strange way, Alan does kind of bring everybody around a central point, which is that Alan doesn't know what he's talking about. Like, yes, and crucially, I noted that this was filmed after the Gal Gadot, Kristen Wiig, you know, multi-celebrity cover of Imagine that generally everyone agreed was a terrible idea by celebrities that now all seem terrible.
Yeah, so I'd imagine that's probably quite a deliberate reference point there because, I think everyone was united in that being rubbish. And also the fact that Alan would think that that's a credible thing to try and do with like younger people, I think also ties in well with the character.
And so, yeah, it's time out, punk bitch. Calm down, Pussy Riot. When I get angry, I walk the dog. And then, yeah, the Imagine by John Lennon idea. And then after this bit, it turns out that he's going to get Tiff down to Cornwall after all. But this very end part felt a little bit odd to me. Firstly, how did they clear the floor of all the protesters so fast? It's like literally 10 seconds later and he's the only one on set. And also, isn't this just set up for some kind of, you know, for the Tiff storyline to continue without really any gags? It just feels like a bit of a deflated moment after the kind of the frenzy that's just happened in the episode.
Well, I think that's a fair point. Yeah, I think the gag in it is, of course, that she's going to have to get herself a non-flexible off-peak ticket to Cornwall. He's not even going to drive her. So there is an inherent gag in there. But yeah, I think the way this ended, I'm just really keen to see if and how this storyline picks up next week to kind of see where this is leading us, because we've only got one episode left. So hopefully this is coming to some kind of fruition.
Yes, we shall have to tune in next week to see the Partridge Universe bring its latest installment to a gripping conclusion.
Okay, so that's kind of the end of the episode. So quick summary, because it's quite a long ep for us already, I think. Tom, what did you make of it overall?
I thought this episode was all right. I would say it's probably... I can't remember too many proper times I laughed out loud
like it didn't get too many big laughs from me. Like I mentioned earlier, I think it kind of moved the narrative on a bit. But yeah, in general, I thought it was okay.
I would personally say for me, this is probably the weakest so far. I mean, I'll always enjoy it. And, you know, it was a fun episode. It did have some enjoyable moments in it. But overall, it's probably my least favourite so far.
I really enjoyed the sort of marriage of pushing the narrative on whilst also keeping things funny. I did think it fell apart a little bit in the third act in that the protest was too close to Shona McGough or Know Me, Knowing You for me. And I didn't think that the kind of musical element was particularly great.
See, for me, it's interesting that everyone's opinion is quite different on this. For me, this would probably be in the top three episodes of what we've had so far. I really liked, because, you know, we got to see Alan having a lovely time in a Spitfire, but I really liked the Chaos of the Streakers because it reminded me of Know Me, Knowing You. The interactions with Lynn were great. I think the evolving the relationships between Alan, Jenny and Tiff, I'm really keen to see where that goes. Also, to see if there is a payoff with the Princess Anne interview. I mean, that said, I think some bits didn't go anywhere. Like, I think the troll interview was a bit of a letdown. But on the whole, I really enjoyed this one.
So that's what we thought. We'd love to hear from you with one episode left in the series. What did you think of this week's episode? What do you think of the series as a whole? And crucially, what's going to happen in the finale? Drop us an email at thepartridgepod@gmail.com. We're on facebook.com/thepartridgepod, Twitter @thepartridgepod, Instagram @monkeytennispod. The Monkey Tennis Hotline is awaiting your voice notes on 07923 600017. If you've enjoyed our dissection and celebration of this time series two, you can shout us the price of a cup of coffee or an equivalent donation. If you want to get one for all of us, that's £15 ko-fi.com/monkeytennis. Thank you so much to all of the generous listeners that have put their hands in their pockets so far. We really appreciate it, and it helps us bring you more Monkey Tennis in the future, so thanks for that. And also thanks very much for listening from all of us at Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. Thanks and goodbye.
It's that time.
What time?
High time to say, if you've got time to give this time your time, then it's time to let this time spend time making your time a good time on this time.
Monkey Tennis? Please, please, cook your eggs. Be safe. Be egg safe. Monkey Tennis?
Well, have a glass of water, please.
It falls to me to say he is gone.
Monkey Tennis?
I said I'd find out more. I haven't done that.
Pay for dinner, yeah?
Monkey Tennis?
I said, who the hell is that?
That's merely a shaved boy in a wig.
Monkey Tennis?
There is broad agreement that John was good.
Tommy, join me at the Lady.
The show that promises to be all things
to all men.
Women.
And everything in between.
Monkey Tennis?
There's a subtle cock up there.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.